Despite the frequent votes in the U.S. House, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, is the law of the land. But the frequent votes and even statements from ACA supporters display the many criticisms of health care reform in America. Many people who have pushed for health care reform for a long time wanted to see us move to a single-payer system, something like the Medicare system for seniors, only expanded to include everybody in the country. We'd have one entity, a government one, paying all the medical bills. The single-payer supporters did not get their way, but they are still seeking it. The supporters include University of Massachusetts economist Gerald Friedman, who's planning a speaking tour of Oregon cities next week, Wednesday in Eugene, Thursday in Ashland and Medford, Friday in Corvallis. Professor Gerald Friedman is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Let's start off with just some of the basic stuff. Single-payer, as you define it, it's got some subtle variations from place to place, it seems. So I want to get your definition of single-payer first.
Well, single-payer means public payment and private provision of health care. The federal government would pick up all the bills, or if it was a state system, the state of Oregon would pick up all the bills with revenue coming from taxes or fees, and you would go to the doctor of your choice. You would swipe a card, or they'd do some other electronic fund transfer, and the money would go from the state or federal agency to the provider, with no insurance company in between.
Now, the private
everybody would be covered for everything. The system that I've proposed would have no co-payments and no deductibles.
So you'd never have anything out of pocket.
That's right. That's right.
And how heavy would the taxes have to be to support such a system as you envision it?
Well, in state, generally speaking, tax rates would be in the 10% range, 10% of payroll, 10% of other forms of income, which is significantly less than people are paying now for health care, because the single-payer system would allow for significant economies. We spend in this country about twice as much as other countries like Canada, spend for health care. And they have longer life expectancy. They go to the doctor more often than we do. The difference between the United States and other countries is we have an enormous administrative cost, which comes to well over 30% of the cost of health care in this country is for billing and insurance-related activities and other administrative activities. The average health insurance company runs up an administrative bill of 15 to 20% compared to less than 2% for traditional Medicare. So it's much more expensive to administer the fragmented insurance system that we have, the fragmented payment system. By cleaning that up and just having a single payer, we would save so much money that we could, well, in the state of Oregon, for example, I estimate a $42 billion being spent on health care in the coming year. $8 billion would be saved with a single-payer system, one-fifth. And that would allow enough to do away with co-pays, allow everybody to go to the doctor whenever they felt, people feel the need. Everyone would be able to fill their prescriptions when they need. And it would still save, after all those other expenses, it would still save $6 billion.
Right out of the gate, Professor Friedman, you talked about public payment, but private provision. I think this is probably part of the place where people get stuck on single payer. They think it's the whole, I'm going to use quote hands here, government takeover of healthcare. But you're not talking about having the doctors and hospitals be government employees here, are you?
No, that's a completely separate thing. I mean, that's the way they do it in Britain, but it's not the way they do it in Canada. It's not the way they do it in France or Italy. In those countries, you have a single-payer system. The government pays for it all, but doctors are free to work as they please, and you are free to go to whatever doctor you want. Private capitalism in the provision, just government funding, just like we do with Medicare, as you brought up at the beginning.
So let me understand then. The administrative costs are borne primarily by the medical offices and the insurance companies at this point. A lot of money going to administrative costs in both those places, or primarily in the medical practices?
It's actually a little more in the medical practices than in the insurance companies, but it's in both. In Oregon, for example, providers would save $5 billion if we made this transition to a single-payer system. The average American, there are many American hospitals that have more people involved in billing and insurance activities than they have hospital beds. The fastest growth occupation in the American healthcare system has not been doctors or nurses. There's relatively little growth in those, insurance offices. People sitting in cubicles in big warehouse-type buildings, processing paper for all the myriad of different insurance companies, different plans. It's a very complicated system. If you ever saw an a hospital bill, I mean, they can go on for 20 pages, and each item, each line is different for different insurance plans and different companies. So doctors would save through shifting to a single-payer system in Oregon. Providers would save $5 billion. There'd be $2 billion saved by getting rid of administrative activities in private insurance companies. And, you know, the public would save, the average person would save a great deal of money, because what we're paying now for insurance and out-of-pocket is way more than the, you know, there are different ways to finance it, but with something in the order of a 10-12% tax, people, over 80% of the people in Oregon would save money through a single-payer system.
Professor Gerald Friedman is an economist at the University of Massachusetts. He is a single-payer health care supporter. He is coming to Oregon on a bit of a road trip next week, which includes stops in Eugene, Medford, Ashland, and Corvallis, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And you can join our discussion with him in advance of that tour as we talk about single-payer health care and the possibilities for it in America. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Professor Friedman and your phone calls and emails when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Professor Gerald Friedman, an economist at the University of Massachusetts and a supporter of single-payer health care. He is coming to Oregon on a tour May 13th through 19th next week, starting Tuesday in Pendleton, to talk about single-payer health care, financially feasible and preferable. The tour is sponsored by Healthcare for All Oregon, Physicians for a National Health Program, the Oregon Chapter, and the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. You can join the discussion right here, right now on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Jerry, what are your issues with Obamacare, which obviously was Romney Care or something like it in Massachusetts, where you live first?
Yeah, we've been dealing with this for almost 10 years. First, there are a lot of things I like about the Affordable Care Act, the technical name for what we call Obamacare. It will extend health insurance coverage to millions of Americans and will save thousands of lives. Maybe, you know, my rough estimate would be about 50,000 fewer deaths in the United States next year because of the Affordable Care Act. And that's you know, you can't oppose something that does that. And it will reduce health insurance costs for a great many working Americans, those who are getting onto Medicaid, as happens to many working people in Oregon, and through the exchange subsidies. So these are all good things. And it improves the quality of health insurance for everybody by mandating certain coverage, you know, preventive care, women's contraceptive care, et cetera. These are all good things. The problem is it doesn't go nearly far enough. There'll still be 20 million people without health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, even if all the states picked up the Medicaid. Second, it doesn't do anything significant to control health care costs. The White House projects like $800 billion in savings over 10 years. That's 2% of health care costs in the United States. The reason is it doesn't go after the inflated drug prices and inflated administrative bloat that is the real reasons why health care is so much more expensive in this country than in other countries and why it's been going up in cost so much. If you don't control administrative costs and you don't control drug prices, then you can't control costs. And if you don't control costs, then in the long run, more and more Americans are going to be pushed back out of the health insurance system.
Are there any economies of scale that can be found to keep those costs down because there are more people in the health care system now?
There will be some, and that's one of the sources that the White House has for its projected $800 billion in savings over 10 years. More people in the system, it will be easier to administer the health insurance, it will be easier to administer billing and insurance operations. I mean, it will be a little bit more efficient. If we had better medical records, electronic medical records, that may eventually achieve savings. But it's very hard to do that with a fragmented insurance system, a fragmented payment system, because every insurance company has its own codes, its own electronic systems. That's just one example of how hard it is to fix the system unless we change the way we pay for it, the finance side of it. You can't fix what goes on within doctors' offices and improve medical practice and achieve greater efficiencies unless we go after the insurance companies.
And just taking that particular player out of the system paves the way for a whole lot of savings, you're saying?
That's right. That's right. That's where the savings are. I mean, that's where we're different than the rest of the world. Back in 40 years ago, when Canada started its Medicare system, you know, which I really believe they call it that just to tease us. Yeah, they have a Medicare system that covers pretty much everything for everybody with a single-payer system. Back then, 40 years ago, when they went in that direction, we in Canada were spending about the same share of our national income on health care. Now we're spending twice as much as they are because their system has been so much more effective at controlling costs. Well, our system has gone out of, you know, costs have been going crazy. We now pay 60% more for drugs than do people in other countries. The Veterans Administration, which is the one agency of the federal government that seriously, that has the legal authority to negotiate drug prices, they pay drug prices comparable to Canada and Europe. Well, everybody else in the United States pays much higher prices because our insurance system can't bargain effectively with the drug companies. And the Veterans Administration is administered way more efficiently, you know, than other private insurance systems because they don't have to have all the billing insurance activities go on in their hospitals and their facilities. But the average American doctor spends $80,000 on billing and insurance-related activities.
And which obviously involves the hiring of a staff member, right?
Yes.
At least one.
Yes. Yes. That's right. That's right. The average American doctor has more than one person doing billing. Like I said, there are more people doing billing in hospitals than there are doctors. There are, in most hospitals, there are more people doing billing than there are hospital beds. You know, I mean, it's just staggering how much we spend on these activities that contribute nothing to our health. On the contrary, they take away. People get stressed about whether they can go to the doctor. They get stressed about the health insurance. It raises people's blood pressure. And it kills people. If you look at counties in Oregon or counties throughout the country, places where more people report difficulty accessing health insurance because of cost, which is something that doesn't happen, you know, in a place like Britain and barely happens in Canada. But about 40% of Americans report that last year they did not do some medical thing, fill a prescription, go to a doctor, have follow-up care because of cost. Places where they have more troubles are places with poorer people, predictably, and they are places with more mortality. If we had British rates of access, that is, only 4% of Americans had trouble accessing the healthcare system because of cost, we would save 200,000 lives across this country. I believe 12,000 in Oregon alone.
Professor Gerald Friedman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an economist from the University of Massachusetts, a supporter of single-payer health care. Here's an email from Mark in Ashland. He wants to know, what is the economic impact of single-payer system? Say, net jobs created as a result of Oregon moving to a single-payer system. Which jobs are lost and which ones gained?
Well, there would be jobs lost. There'd be jobs lost in the billing and insurance activities in hospitals and doctor's offices. Some of those people would transition to working in the expanded health provision system, because doctors would be hiring more clinical assistants and more people for health-related activities.
The kinds of people who make sure that diabetes patients stay on their meds, that sort of thing?
Exactly. Exactly. Overall, there would be net job loss in the administrative side, balanced by those healthcare jobs, and people would have more money to spend, and they would be spending it on, you know, summer vacations, buying a new boat instead of paying so much in health insurance premiums. The average worker in Oregon could buy a new boat, and people would be getting jobs building those boats. So overall, there would be net job creation. I estimate, and if Oregon does it alone, also Oregon would become a very attractive place to do business. People in businesses in Washington would move across the border to get cheaper health care coverage for their workers. I estimate that a single payer system in Oregon would save as many as 80,000 jobs, would create net 80,000 jobs because of the lower costs of operating health care in Oregon.
So not a wash on jobs, but a net gain of 80,000.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So those people who are displaced from billing operations, you know, the average, these are bad jobs. The average person doing a billing, average billing worker, quits her job, and they're usually mostly women, quit their job every 2 years. They're not high-paying jobs. They're not desirable jobs. Programs like H.R. 676 on the national level, the single-payer law nationally, they provide for 2 years of unemployment insurance and job training, you know, to help people do the transition. But they'll be able to transition to new jobs because if you lower the cost of hiring workers by doing away with the burden of health care, then businesses will be able to flourish, investment will come in, and there'll be more jobs created.
Professor Gerald Friedman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an economist at the University of Massachusetts, a single-payer health care supporter. He'll be in Oregon next week talking about single-payer health care as financially feasible and preferable, with stops in Eugene on Wednesday, Ashland and Medford on Thursday, and Friday in Corvallis. You can join the discussion right here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Anywhere you can hear us, our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's an email from Kat, no town given. She says, as an Australian citizen who had great experience with it, I totally support single-payer systems, but why is the tax rate that Jerry's suggesting so high? 10%. I'm from Australia, and the Medicare tax rate is under 2%. Australians are liable to pay the Medicare levy, of which the standard is 1.5% of taxable income.
The Australian system is subsidized through general income taxation. Also, to be sure, I've tried very hard to be conservative in my projections for the savings from a single-payer system in Oregon. So you may be able to do better than the rates that I'm talking about. I include a substantial surplus at the end of the end of the day. But you are comparing apples and oranges. It would be great if we could do it at 2%, but I don't think we can. The share of national income going to health care in most advanced economies other than the United States is 10-12%. So basically, you have to come up with 10-12% of income to fund the system. And, you know, that's not going to go away. I mean, right now we're paying 18% of our national income for health care. As I said, close to half of that is waste. You get rid of that, yeah, you bring it down to 10%, but it's not going to go much below that.
You had mentioned Oregon as a potential place where there might be a single-payer system at some point. Vermont is already moving in this direction with trying to turn Green Mountain Care into a single-payer system, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And you're assisting that process?
I've been involved in it. I've consulted a little bit with the single-payer side of it. Oddly enough, I also consulted with the State Employees Union, which is concerned to protect its health insurance. There we see one of the problems, because unions have negotiated good health insurance while trading off for wages. Now, if you're going to put everybody into the health insurance, they want some of those wages back that they had negotiated away to protect the health insurance. So it gets complicated, which the point is that there are a lot of people who will, the great majority of population will benefit from this transition to single payer, but there are a lot of vested interests that have a stake in the current system. Some unions and some people, you know, in particular, but the largest stakeholders who benefit from the system are the CEOs and top management of drug companies and health insurance companies. The six largest health insurers average CEO pay of over $15 million last year.
$15 million a year average?
No, a year. Yeah. If you go to a few examples, George Paz of Express Scripts, he was paid $59 million last year. Steve Hemsley of United Health Group, $49 million. Angela Brawley of WellPoint, $21 million. Mark Bartolini of Aetna, $49 million. I believe he got a big raise this year. So these people have a very strong vested interest in keeping our current inefficient system. And the drug companies are enormously profitable, too, and they will be losing a lot of their profits under single payer. So that's where the opposition comes from, and so far they've been able to roll over all the great hundreds of millions of people who will benefit from single payer.
All right, so then now that does get into political realities when we're starting to talk about moving into a system that really gores the ox of people who have a lot of money right now under the current system and a lot of money to spend in an American system that identifies money as speech on campaigns against change. So how do you make headway against that?
Well, we need to do it the way all the great reforms have come to this country. Abolition, votes for women, labor union rights, pensions, Social Security pensions, civil rights, all of these campaigns were achieved over the opposition of enormously powerful people who had vested interests in the status quo. And they've happened through popular movements. And that's what we're talking about doing in Oregon. That's why I'm coming out there, to give people, you know, the facts, you know, facts that are, in effect, ammunition in a popular campaign to overcome the opposition of the insurance industry and the vested interests. You know, at the end of the day, for all their millions of dollars, they still get only one vote per person. And we can outvote them. We outnumber them.
The one of the avenues of study that you pursue is the decline of liberalism in America. And I wonder if in that context, if you think that Bill Clinton blew a golden opportunity to pass health care reform early in his term in 1993.
Well, in hindsight's 2020. I mean, there were two questions there. One is, would we have been better off even if he hadn't been able to push through a single-payer system, if he had just supported it and proposed it, like Harry Truman did, and like the Committee on Economic Security that under Franklin Roosevelt, and, you know, kind of raise the flag and fight for that standard, even if we wouldn't have been able to get it through right away. The second is, why didn't some of the largest corporations in America support health care reform, you know, even single payer? Because companies like General Motors and Chrysler still spend huge amounts on health insurance. American businesses, apart from the cost of premiums for their workers, they spend $32 billion administering the health care system, the health insurance system. You're processing paper, choosing insurance plans. And great many small employers, people I know in Amherst, Massachusetts, run small businesses, they hate having to deal with it. Because, you know, they have very great uncertainty in what their health insurance will cost, and they have to go to their workers and choose among the preferences of different workers in different positions. Like, and they have to think about if somebody gets cancer, if somebody gets really sick, then the health insurance premiums will skyrocket. And that's very, you know, you don't want to think about that when you're hearing that somebody's gotten sick, that, oh, my God, I'm going to be paying a lot more in health insurance. But that's the reality. So I think that we need to make alliances with businesses, which hasn't happened yet, especially small businesses that pay health insurance now for their workers. You know, they should be behind this campaign. They have an economic interest in this, you know, apart from the sense of humanity. So we need to reach out further to them, and we need to mobilize people, get people out on the streets and protesting, because nothing else makes change happen in this country except popular movements.
Professor Gerald Friedman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an economist at the University of Massachusetts, a supporter of single-payer health care. He will be speaking about single-payer health care on a tour of Oregon next week, which again includes stops. Well, let's give the whole list. Pendleton, LeGrand, Eugene, Medford, Ashland, Corvallis, Portland, Bend, and Portland again, running from the 13th to the 19th of May. You can join him here on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Back with Jerry Friedman and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Professor Gerald Friedman, an economist at the University of Massachusetts and a supporter of single-payer health care. He'll be on a tour of Oregon May 13th through 19th talking about single-payer health care. The talk is entitled Financially Feasible and Preferable. Stops include Eugene on Wednesday, Ashland and Medford on Thursday, and Corvallis on Friday of next week. But you can join the discussion right here, right now, on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Glenn in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jerry Friedman.
Yeah, hi. I want to have a question about the relative costs in other countries for health care. And you tossed out the number 50% less for most of these countries. And the ones I've kind of read about are between 30 and 50% less in those other countries. And that seems to be more in line with your comparison of the U.S. and Australia. You said 18 versus 12. That's more like 30%. And then I wanted to know where those numbers come from, who's done the studies, who's paid for them. Have any sort of Republican-affiliated think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, have they done any of those studies, and have they come up with similar numbers?
Oh, good questions. Thanks for that, Glenn. Appreciate it. Jerry?
Come from the numbers of what people, different countries are spending, come from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a totally nonpartisan organization. I don't believe that Heritage or any other group does their own collections of these data. The Commonwealth Fund does do some collections of its own, but basically everybody uses the OECD. They've got a great website if you want to go to it. If you look at it, I'm sorry, I was wrong about Australia. I'm just looking at it now. In 2010, they spent 9% of national income on health care. Sweden spent 9.6. The United States spent 18. Switzerland, which was number two in the world, spent 11%. Netherlands. The Netherlands spent 12%. Overall, we spend about twice the average. Canada spends 11%. We spend 18%.
And this is 12%, 18% of GDP we're talking about?
Yes. Okay. Of GDP, gross domestic product, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And that's from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. They also collect data on the breakout of public and private expenditures. If you get rid of all private expenditures, we spend about 10% of our national income on public health care spending, a little more than half of our total, which means that we spend as much publicly as does Australia now. So if we get rid of all private spending and we're as efficient as Australia, where people live longer than in the United States, then we wouldn't need any new taxes. But I'm not assuming that we suddenly move to be as efficient as these other countries. It would be nice if we did. Yeah, but
to some degree, has the working of the American system dictated the access to delivery, in the sense that because there have been so many people who don't have insurance, or have poor enough insurance that they choose to skip going to the doctor's office. If everybody could go to the doctor's office, do we then run into a shortage of doctors, longer waits, et cetera, because of the system that grew up because of the money that was available?
Yeah, well, we would have an increase in utilization. And I've actually, over the last few years, I've been revising upwards my estimate of what would happen to utilization, because insurance plans are becoming so restrictive. The proportion of Americans who report that they had a cost-related problem keeping them from going to the doctor or filling a prescription has gone up from 25% 15 years ago to 40% today. That's included an increase among people who have health insurance. 60% of those without health insurance report some problem. So we would have an increase in utilization of maybe 9 or 10% between bringing insurance coverage to everybody and people using physician services more. How large is that? I mean, doctors would be saving several hours a week, which they're now spending dealing with health insurance. The average American doctor spends 2 to 3 hours a week of his or her own time dealing with insurance companies. We would do away with that completely, and that would save 7 or 8% of doctors' time, and that would cover most of the increased utilization. There would be some pockets, you know, there'd be extra demand for primary care, which would be a little bit harder to deal with. But overall, I think we'd be able to accommodate the system with relatively small adjustments. You know, there may be pressure to use more nurse practitioners instead of physicians. That might not be a bad idea anyway, but I think we'll be able to handle it.
Here's a call from Don and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking single-payer health care with Professor Gerald Friedman.
Hello, Dr. Friedman. On Frontline a few years ago, there was a really interesting comparison of the healthcare plans of different countries, Japan, Germany, the United States, and interestingly, Taiwan, which had adopted one. It's been about 10 years since they, I believe, adopted a single-payer system, which is very popular, and they're very happy with it. However, following that up, I've kind of noticed that they're having trouble keeping it funded. They have to keep borrowing money, and that politicians can't run against it. And, they can't, there's a lack of critical adjustment somehow within the system. But the people are still very happy with it. Could you comment on their health care system?
All right, thanks for that, Don.
Well, every health care system in the world is going to experience rising costs to some extent because the population is getting older, and that's the biggest single driver, of course, is age. And second, as countries get richer, which happens, you know, in normal process of economic growth, people want more health care. So health care costs throughout the world have risen relative to other things. Plus, health care is a labor-intensive activity, so it's hard to substitute robots for doctors. I mean, you don't want to see a robot. You want to see a doctor. So health care does become more expensive. And when, you know, you go into a period of, like we've had the last 6-7 years, of fiscal stringency with the Great Recession that's gone on throughout the world, government tax revenues are squeezed and expenditures go up for unemployment care and other social programs, health care becomes an issue. I don't know the details in Taiwan, but I imagine that's what's been going on there. But people still throughout the world like their health care systems more than Americans do. Only 20-25% of Americans report being very satisfied with their health care system. Those are probably people who haven't had to see a doctor lately. That's not really meant as a joke. It's meant as serious. I mean, if everybody else who's seen a doctor and had to deal with insurance, or everybody who works in the health care system and has to deal with insurance companies, is unhappy with the health care system we have in this country. In the rest of the world, it's almost completely flipped. In Italy, 70% of the population likes their health care system. In Britain, 70% like their health care system. Taiwan, the switch to single payer has been very popular. It's interesting, costs go up, but it happens less in systems with single payer, where governments are more effective at controlling costs through restricting monopolistic practices and controlling by drug companies and controlling administrative waste.
Let's take another call. We have Ginger and Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Gerald Friedman. He's boosting single-payer health care.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Friedman. I appreciate this discussion. I lived in Germany for a number of years, and having the awareness that people from the time they get their very first job at age 18 or 20, automatically pay into the system kind of, illustrates how crazy it is here that people object to having to purchase, be told that they have to have health insurance. If it's on an automatic basis, it's just a norm. And, of course, people that are 18 and 20 also need to go to doctors. It's not that they don't. It's just amazing to me that people object so much to having to, pay into the system when it could be a relatively painless process.
All right. Thanks for that, Ginger. So how do you overcome the resistance? I mean, particularly in a country that seems to be allergic to taxes, or at least a large portion of the population is.
Yeah, well, I think we need to be careful about who in this country is allergic to taxes and who in this country objects to paying and, to getting health insurance. I think we saw with the rush of people previously uninsured into the Affordable Care Act exchanges that a great many Americans don't have health insurance, really want health insurance, and haven't been able to get it before. But given the opportunity to get it at an affordable price through the Affordable Care Act, they jumped at the chance. The Koch brothers and others, who've been attacking the so-called mandate, are people who have health insurance, and they're, for whatever reason, don't want other people to get it. One of the reasons they don't want to get it is because they don't want to be paying higher taxes. And if you come to my talks, you'll see my estimates of the impact of a single-payer system in Oregon, which is similar to what I've done for the nation as a whole. Lower-income people would save a lot of money. Middle-income people would save some money. Upper-middle-income people would save a little money. But the very richest people would be paying a lot more under the single-payer programs that we've talked about than they're paying now. Because any form of income-related taxation, or any form that links what you pay for health care to your ability to pay, means that richer people will be paying a higher percent, more of the burden, would be paying more of the burden of health care costs. And low-income people who are now getting real, the average low-income person is paying 20-25% of their income towards health care, either through premiums or out-of-pocket costs. That would be cut dramatically under what we're talking about.
Let's take another call. Here's Ruth in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jerry Friedman.
Hi, I appreciate this conversation so much, and I'm so in favor of single payer. But Obama said at the beginning if he were setting it up, he would have gone with single payer, but he couldn't under the circumstances. So my question is, can the economy survive with such a big element of it being insurance? And how would that work if we got rid of all the medical insurance companies?
All right. Thanks for that, Ruth. So what do the insurance companies do under this system, Jerry?
They would go out of business as far as health insurance. They would,
but they could still offer life and cars and home and that stuff, right?
That's right. They'd still be selling those other forms of insurance, but they wouldn't be selling health insurance. I mean, a very small part of the business might be, as happens with Medicare, where the government would contract for some of the billing activities, but that would be very small. It'd be nothing compared to what's going on now. I mean, I drive by in Hartford, Connecticut. Route 91 goes by Hartford.
Interstate 91, yeah, know it well.
91, yeah, okay, you know it. And you see these gleaming towers that are the health insurance companies.
Travelers and Phoenix Mutual, yeah, know them all.
yep, and they'd find other things to do, and they wouldn't be as profitable. The drug companies would also lose money, although they'd continue to be in business because they'd still be making some money out of the, of their pharmaceuticals. But a lot of the activities, that go on in the insurance industry would continue. property, life, casualty, et cetera.
So you mentioned earlier the John Conyers bill for single-payer national health care, H.R. 676. I'm going to guess it didn't even get a hearing. I checked out its status yesterday. In February of last year, it was referred to the Subcommittee on Indian and Alaska Native Affairs, which seems like a place where bills go to die.
Yeah. I think the Republicans in Congress will might be making a change and after Obama is no longer president, or maybe even while he is, because they don't have an alternative to the Affordable Care Act.
You mean with repeal and replace, and they don't mention what the replace would be?
Yeah. And, you know, a single payer, especially allowing state single payers, which is allowed as of 2017 in the Affordable Care Act, but making it easier for state single payers could be a solution for them. They could sponsor this as federalism, as something that's good for business, and an alternative to the ACA. The Democrats aren't going to do anything with single payer for at least the next couple of years because they are in a bunker mentality defending the ACA, which is worth defending. I don't want to criticize that. But they're not looking beyond it. But in 5 years, when there's still 20 million people without health insurance, and when health insurance costs are continuing to rise at 6-7% a year, well above the rate of gross domestic product, well above the rate of increase in wages, then we're going to be back to this. And the alternatives at that point will be, do we cut health care access because we can't afford it, or do we find a way to make the system more efficient? And at that point, I think Republicans will join with Democrats in adopting the only thing that really can achieve efficiency, single payer.
We will see. Professor Gerald Friedman will be on tour in Oregon next week. Again, May 14th, Wednesday in Eugene, May 15th, Thursday in Ashland and Medford, Friday, May 16th in Corvallis. Jerry Friedman, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Pat.
You bet. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to Professor Christy Dotson about race and the invisibility of black women. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about passenger trains as National Train Day approaches. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.